This is episode 33. The date today is May 12th. I had to look and double check. May 12th, 2016, and I'm the co-host of Radio Warnerd, Mark Ames. I'm in Queens. I'm on the line now with the Warnerd, John Dolan, Gary Brecher. You know him as both. And John, are you there? Do you hear me? And where are you? And are you alive?
I hear you. I'm alive. I'm sweating. Or at least I was sweating until I got into the business center of this five-star hotel where I am now. And I wouldn't want any of our subscribers to think their money is going for five-star hotels. Believe me, that's several stars too high. But the connection in the hotel where we're staying was pretty much a two-star connection. So these top-of-the-line hotels are, according to what I could find online, the best place to do online interviews in Phnom Penh.
No, that sounds right. I remember when I traveled around a bit when I was younger that you do try to find, you can't stay in the five-star hotels, but you try to find them for things like, first of all, cooling off. They always have cool lobbies. So if you're somewhere hot, you know you can just hang out there and hope you don't get kicked out. And maybe just like nurse a cup of coffee or a Coke the whole time. And then things like communications, the internet, and maybe like a clean bathroom if you're in a particular place.
So they
can be useful. Yeah.
All the luxuries. The bathroom here even has little towelettes in it. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. The 1%, even in Pol Pot's former digs. So tell me how it is there. I mean, from your last really grim, harrowing newsletter from the museums, the genocide museums there. I mean, it sounds like the heat there is unbearable. I mean, by any standard, it's just absolutely unbearable.
It's not just unbearable; it's unprecedented. I mean, this is the hottest temperatures that have ever been recorded in Southeast Asia. I mean, it's up to like 45°C or 113 Fahrenheit. And, you know, you can get temperatures like that in Kuwait, but that's a desert. This is not a desert. It was once a rainforest. It's not a rainforest anymore, but the humidity is still here. And the combination is dizzying. I mean, the sky is a color I've never quite seen, a kind of hostile brown gray. And there's a weird sort of lightheadedness that comes over you after a while. And, you know, you have this impression that the locals must be fine with it, but they're not fine with it at all. And it's scaring them because they live in a place where they have to fear the heat the way a 19th century Russian would fear the cold. Mm-hmm. It may not be as likely to kill you, but it's definitely well able to make your life utterly miserable. And it's hotter than it's ever been for them.
And drought. I mean, so you have heat like that and drought.
The rainy season failed. Oh. Yeah. Supposedly the Mekong is drying up in places, and what little is left of the wildlife and what little is left of the forest is dying because nothing is growing. The herbivores have nothing to eat. They die, then the predators die. It's a pretty grim apocalyptic feel to this city. You get the feeling that outdoors is as hostile here as, say, outdoors in Moscow in January would have been 100 years ago.
Right. That's awful. So are they ascribing it to global warming, or are they ascribing it to like an El Nino, La Nina thing? Because I know that, you know, on the America, the West Coast especially, had the El Nino, La Nina thing. So first there was a drought, and now they're getting somewhat deluged with rain. If you remember that when we were younger, we had
Yeah, California was always either flooding or drought when I was growing up, mostly, but more often drought than flooding. And as for the cause, I mean, it seems pretty clearly related to global warming, but I don't know that the Cambodians are in a mood to blame anybody. They've been through so much, I think, and this is just a guess because I don't claim to know Cambodia particularly well, but they've been through so much, they're just trying to figure out how you're supposed to live now, and this is just another complication.
Right. So do you have any point? Do you know if you're still going to be here for the next show, or do you know how much longer you're going to be there?
I think we have to leave. I mean, I'm just not handling it. very well. That visit to the museum just about did for me. And I still don't know how to add it up, how much was heat and how much was not so much just the horror of it, but the word that kept coming to mind was incommensurate. I mean, you're at this museum where people are describing how they had their fingernails pulled out in little special fingernail pulling machines. And you're being waltzed around by guides, and you're going to, you know, stop at the little stands under the trees where people who survived these hideous things are now trying to make a little money selling their memoirs. And meanwhile, the heat is like something on the surface of Venus, and none of it adds up. You stare out at the skyline, and the sky again looks like another planet, and there are these weird half-finished high rises all over the place. And where is the Khmer Rouge now? I mean, where are the Killing Fields now? It's all gone. I mean, part of it is something in general about the tropics, in that people are younger in most of the tropics than they are in the first world, and I think younger people don't really want to know. I mean, they're not that interested. They're trying to make a career for themselves. I mean, to get a bike, I think, is your first goal here, because right. On a bike you can zoom around the traffic and you create your own breeze, which is really, really important. And then you probably want something better than a bike, like a bike big enough that you can put a family on. And there's still a pretty high birth rate in Cambodia, unlike Thailand, by the way. I mean, people don't realize this, but Thailand has a rate way below replacement. Because it's a richer country, and that can happen really fast. But in Cambodia, it's still 2.7 children per woman. And they're trying to take care of the kids and trying to, I don't know, after you get a bike, maybe you can buy an AC unit. And after that, you're probably pretty much set.
Yeah. And also we saw, I mean, it's the really dark, depressing history that young people, especially shortly after around the time you're expected to come to terms with it, usually they don't want to hear about it. And we saw this in Russia, too, in the 90s. Nobody, the last thing they wanted to hear about or talk about were, you know, Stalin's crimes. I mean, except for a very small class of kind of liberal intelligentsia. They just, I remember for a lot of friends of mine from different walks of life, they would just roll their eyes. I remember showing a couple of them that movie Chekist, which is a really dark, horrific movie, you know, just one execution after another, boom, 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 in this dirty, filthy cellar. And they were bored. Like, so what? Move on, you know?
I think a lot of it feels like being scolded, and you don't know why you're being scolded. You didn't do any of this, and you don't want to know about it, because what's the rhetorical purpose of something like that? Either it implies that your country suffers from some sort of original sin that will haunt you all your life, or since it didn't happen in your life and you didn't do it, it has no relation to you. And given those options, any sane person would choose the one that says nothing to do with me.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have to get scolded by Ann Applebaum for the rest of your life.
That's right. I mean, long ago, I tried to get down to that question. She wrote, that we must remember the Gulag book. And the question that kept coming to my mind is, why? I mean, not that I don't think it should be remembered, but I want Ann Applebaum, who very much has an agenda of her own, to explain exactly why Ann Applebaum and her Polish nationalist husband want it remembered. Right. Because no historical fact is offered innocently. They're picked and chosen. I mean, we talked about the Opium War, and by any standards, the Opium War, the Indian Mutiny were vast atrocities, and they're completely forgotten now because, among other reasons, they have no bearing on Ann Applebaum's agenda. They actually tend to get in the way of that agenda. And so those corpses tend not to be thrown in anybody's face. Other corpses are thrown in people's faces.
I mean, Churchill's Holodomor, for lack of a better word, is his genocide by starvation in Bengal in 1943.
Right.
It was very intentional, aware and conscious. It's very inconvenient, so it doesn't count.
Yeah, I actually had an interesting comment after that show from someone who's involved in a post-colonial studies program now at graduate level, and they said that there's no discussion of that at all. It's almost as if they discuss colonial crimes as matters of giving offense to people, not referring to them in respectful terms, not dealing with their customs in an appropriate manner, as opposed to, say, starving them to death intentionally, forcibly subjecting them to addictive drugs in order to make a profit. None of that is somehow important in the post-colonial studies agenda at the moment.
Wow. Yeah, and it just happens to coincide with, you know, with keeping the order of things the way they are. And you know, the other thing is, as we were talking about this, you know, the gulags. Well, you know, what about the Bengal? There's this saying. I think you probably missed it being outside of the country. This new sort of retort from apologists for the Ukraine regime, basically, which turned out to be, you know, a really awful revolution or coup, whatever you call it, the Maidan one, and brought in all kinds of neo-fascists and with sort of neoliberals at the peak of it. But every time you bring up something else, the counter-argument now, the big sort of Western apologist counter-argument is to call these things whataboutism. And it's just a way of dismissing having the answer for. I mean, to me, it's kind of amazing that it even works at all. That it's adopted.
Wait. Let me get that straight. This is actually a term.
Yes.
What about it?
Yes, it's a big one. And like Peter Pomerantsev, for example, who I wrote about, who wrote the book "Nothing Is True" and everything. I can't remember the name of it right now off the top of my head, but he's the guy. He's sort of the big.
Nothing is true, but I've got a book contract.
Nothing is true, but I work for the Legatum Institute, which is run by neocons and billionaire vulture fund capitalists. So it's their counter to when you bring up, and there's plenty of bad to bring up about Russia or Putin, and then you sort of try to give context to it, or you talk about, you know, the incredible hypocrisy of it, given like a laundry list of things that are going on today from America and the West, or that have gone on, you know, historically, and they just call that whataboutism. Say, oh look, a squirrel, whataboutism. You know, and they think it works, and in a weird way, on a lot of idiots, it does work. It's just, I mean, they don't even try to, you know, to come up with a counter argument. It's sort of like if I even come up with a counter argument, that in itself is propaganda to even have to answer you. I don't have to answer you. You know,
that's characteristic of really degraded rhetorical environment. It reminds me of 19th century Russian discourse at its worst. Like, this is a Blomovism. Oh, okay. Well, if it's a Blomovism, then I have to stop. I mean, the fact that this is an academic habit, too, that I remember all too well. Schopenhauer actually talks about this as a method of academic argument at its worst. He says, and you could tell Schopenhauer is talking from his own bitter experience, you can spend 10 years elucidating a theory, and then some half-assed academic will say, oh, that is Manichaeanism. And once it's been classed, once it's been given that name, this fits in my glossary under Manichaeanism, then it's as if it has no more power.
Yeah.
It's been dismissed.
And, you know, and the reality is, I mean, that can work. That's the reality of rhetoric. You know, you have to point it out. You have to point out the flaw in it, because on non-rhetorically minded, you know, people that can kind of work. People don't want to feel like idiots. They don't want to be in the side of the uncool, right? So if you say that's whataboutism, then I think, oh wow, I don't want to be on the whataboutism crowd, you know.
So could I be a whataboutist?
Or am I a neo-whataboutist? You know, it's bad. So, right. So I know we're going to talk about Yemen this show. It's a pretty amazing war history. And as you point out in your notes here, you can't even really pinpoint when to begin this story. But before we get to that, I just wanted to go back to Khmer Rouge again real quickly. The Khmer Rouge and your experience there. And First of all, their sayings. I mean, do you remember some of their incredible sayings? Like, it's Mao's sayings were we're not menacing like this Maus were. No. I mean, that sound like Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now. You know, the man, he wrote poetry. Yeah. He really did. Whereas Pol Pots are about the scariest things I've ever seen.
Yeah, they're just mean. They're poetic threats, which is not exactly true of Mao. Mao certainly contained a lot of threat, but there was usually an option. Mao, for example, those who oppose the revolution will be ground to dust. Therefore, if you do not wish to be ground to dust, try not opposing the revolution. But there's never that kind of option in Pol Pot's sort of pedantic dweeb threats. You know, like, they have a certain beauty to them that I recognize because they're poetry, they're nasty kind of poetry. They're balanced phrases often, like he had a classical education from the French, even though he didn't do particularly well at it, did Salazar, a.k.a. Pol Pot. So he came up with very balanced Roman pithy and bloody aphorisms like, to keep you is no gain, to destroy you is no loss.
That's the amazing one. Yeah.
Yeah. Very memorable. I just read a couple of biographies, memoirs rather, by people who survived Tuol Sleng, the torture camp in Phnom Penh. And that's, you know, it's a significant sample because only seven people survived, and these are two of their memoirs. And they both bring up that saying as being the anthem of the Khmer Rouge. But, you know, any admiration for its poetic qualities tends to fade when you read their descriptions of being tortured really avidly by the perfect sadistic human material, 17-year-old boys with no education and no family. That's what the Khmer Rouge picked by choice. They wanted somebody really young, mean, dumb. And when, you know, you hear about these people who'd actually built a life and a family before the revolution, having these idiots jump on their stomach until they died while shouting that line at them really kind of destroys the beauty of it.
Yeah, and here's another one. It's set up almost as some kind of semi-antithesis, but it's, he who protests is an enemy, he who opposes is a corpse. I think either one is a corpse in that case, but I don't know.
That was the rule. I mean, literally the rule of ANCAR, as the Khmer Rouge called itself, the organization, literally the rule was everyone arrested must be killed. So these balanced phrases in which there are different options were a lie from the beginning. You were going to die anyway. But they all stink of the lycée in some way. They remind me of something Céline said. He said, I read these lycée boys, and somebody says, what a beautiful sentence, what periods, how smoothly the antitheses. Yeah. I say, it's unreadable. I can't hear it. It's garbage.
Yeah. The Latin, you know, it's not spoken. It's clearly taught, you know, taught to them and sort of burned into their brains, this Latin construction, right?
Yeah. It would have been a lot better for everybody if they just said, do what we say or we'll kill you, and then we'll kill you anyway.
Yeah, but then there'd be no little red book to compete with Mao's, you know, as part of it. Here's another one. The sick are victims of their own imagination.
I don't even know what that one means. What was it?
I think it means almost everyone's sick here, and it's not our fault; it's their fault.
Yeah. There was a lot of that. Like, I'm innocent, people would say as their fingernails were being pulled out, and there was a set reply for that, which is ANCAR never arrests the wrong person. And it's like, oh, okay, sorry,
right.
My mistake. Keep pulling.
Right. Well, and there's also, you know, better to arrest and execute 10 innocent people than to let one guilty person go. That was a big one, too. Something along those lines, but which is something like a Bertolt Brecht line.
It sounds, as they say, venerable. It sounds like it's been around for a long, long time.
I think
I think most people believe it.
Yes,
they don't say it.
Yeah, that's true. So, so you talked about in your newsletter that you did you pick up these memoirs? I mean, there are these two people outside of the museum, the Genocide Museum, selling different memoirs, one named Survivor and the other Mao Bang, I believe. Did you have a chance to, so these were in English, they were hawking them, their own memoirs?
Yeah, they were hawking them in English. Khmer, I know a little about many languages, and Khmer is one of those languages I really like because I'm not even supposed to know anything about it, so I can just blink right through it. They're definitely in English. I couldn't read a single word in Khmer. The translations aren't always good, but one of the strange disconnects at Tuol Sleng, this hideous place, is that it's also a way for poor people to make a little money. I mean, your guide is this woman who is telling you about how all her family was killed, and she's absolutely telling the truth, but she also needs a little money from you. And on your way out, she leads you towards two trees, one on each side of the path, and staggered a bit. The first tree is where the book called Survivor is sold by one of the seven survivors of the camp. And it seems little enough to do to pay $10 to buy that book from him, which we did. And then she leads you across the path to the other place where Bo Meng is selling his book, which you also buy. And I've read them both in the last day. And they have a horrible sameness like atrocity stories tend to have. But there are interesting differences. Like the guy who wrote the book called Survivor was from a poor family, but he early on decided he wanted to be a mechanic, which in Cambodia in the 1960s was like deciding you wanted to do computers in California in, you know, the 1960s. He was in on the ground floor of a really good business. Mm-hmm. So he built quite a business for his family when the Khmer Rouge arrived. And then, of course, everyone died except him, and the business was destroyed. The other author, Bo Meng, was from a much more damaged family and joined the party very willingly and served it with complete loyalty. And they ended up in the same place and were given the same treatment. And Bo Meng mentions in puzzlement toward the end of his memoir that he still doesn't quite understand why he and everyone at his workplace was arrested. But it seems that it was because they were from the northern section of the Khmer Rouge, or Angkor. And one of the things about the Khmer Rouge is that it was not even really a communist movement as much as a wounded nationalist movement. Cambodia had been getting clawed apart after a forgotten greatness. It was shrinking. The Vietnamese were grabbing at it. The Thai were grabbing at it. And everyone from each section of the country also resented and suspected everyone from the other sections. Like the ones from the east might be Vietnamese agents. The ones from the north or the west might be Thai agents. Anyone from the cities might be a Chinese, American, or Russian agent, because those were urban cultures. And only someone from some imaginary rice paddy in the very center of the Cambodian plain could possibly be legitimate. And even they would probably say something wrong at some point. So this guy, the more loyal of the two, saw his whole family killed because that was policy, simply because he ended up working in the North and the North was suspect. And that was it.
Wow. Yeah. And that whole idea, I mean, it's sort of like, just knowing that Pol Pot had studied where at the Sorbonne, I think, right?
Yeah.
It's like Rousseau gone mad.
Yeah. The idea that you can erase all traces of what you consider an alien culture. I mean, I suppose the whole
also the back to the land. I mean, the purity of the countryside peasant.
Yeah, it's usually something that countryside peasants don't espouse, especially, and given half a chance, they'll move to the capital in a hot second. Right. But people who've who've learned from French academics, who were in no danger of being subjected to anything like the Khmer Rouge themselves, they often take it up very seriously. I think we've talked before about something that Sheshwab Miwos used to teach at Berkeley, which was the idea of Western European intelligentsia as having a certain immunity from the ridiculous ideas they tossed around for fun and for career.
Right.
But that they were teaching those ideas to people who didn't have that same immunity and didn't have the centuries of cultural insulation from literal belief in the more absurd ideas they were teaching, and who might actually go home, like Salazar did after failing his exams in France, and decide that there was a relationship between him failing his exams, the nightmare that the Americans were wreaking on Southeast Asia, and the presence of alien culture in Cambodia. And above all, and this is the part that doesn't get stressed enough, the decline of Cambodia. There's so much wounded ego behind the Khmer Rouge. Mm. And now I want to lower my voice because I don't know who's around here, but I know someone here who was kicked out of a cafe for simply talking about Vietnam without using a pejorative adjective about it. Because even though the Vietnamese are the saviors, I mean, even though the Vietnamese defeated the Khmer Rouge, drove them into the jungles of the Northwest, it really hurts to be liberated by the people who've been gobbling up your country.
Right.
And who you imagine as seeing themselves as superior to you, as seeing themselves as sophisticated and assertive people compared to you, you who are passive peasantry.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot of confusion and anger even now about how to think about the Vietnamese liberation.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So the Vietnamese invaded. I don't know if we want to talk about finish up the Khmer Rouge part or if you even want to maybe put it off a little bit. But as you were talking, a couple things also crossed my mind. One is that somehow, this extremism, this sort of translation into something like really horrific didn't happen with the Vietnamese, despite all of the horrors that we inflicted on them.
Yes.
Yes. And I would honestly argue, and I'm sure a lot of people might disagree, that you could say something similar about the Chinese. I know that the Cultural Revolution was really horrific, and there was a famine. But when you consider what went on, what the British did there, and what the Japanese did there, and the repeated genocides that went on over and over and over, it wasn't like what Mao did was completely out of the ordinary. Unlike Pol Pot, which was definitely out of the ordinary.
Well, yeah, you and I interviewed Philip Short, who wrote excellent biographies of both Pol Pot and Mao. And I recall asking him about this, and he said, look, if you consider the ambient level of violence in pre-Mao China, nothing that Mao did even reached the level of violence of China before Mao. Whereas if you look at the level of violence in Stalin's Russia, or if you look at the post-Mao China versus post-Stalin Russia, you can see that Mao's reign was actually rather good for China, whereas Stalin's reign was not very good for Russia. And Pol Pot's reign was disastrous for Cambodia in every way.
Yeah, it just seems like an incredibly traumatized country, traumatized by its past, traumatized by its present, all around.
And now, yeah, and then under the circumstances, forgetting is probably a really good strategy.
Yes.
I mean, nobody quite knows what, I come back to the Anne Applebaum problem. We must remember the crimes of the past. Well, whose crimes and why? And why? You're always telling somebody else to remember them. I mean, Anglo culture is particularly good at this. You guys need to remember your crimes. You guys need to remember your horrors. And it is not going to help you most of the time to remember those crimes and those horrors. There's this cliche that you need to remember them to avoid repeating them. But countries that are obsessed with wrongs they've committed just tend to be dispirited depressing places.
Or violent, too.
Or they reject it, and they say...
Imagine going to the Appalachian and telling the Hatfields and McCoys, you know what your problem is? You need to remember every single thing. That'll solve it. You know, it's vulgar Freudianism. I mean, Freudianism has seeped so deeply in our basic premises of how things should work and what, you know, what cures things. It's... Forgetting is a good idea.
That's a brilliant way of putting it. I'm trying to remember Freud dealing with the Hatfields and the McCoys. God darn, doctor, now I suddenly get it. I'm going to become a vegetarian now.
Well, it's because I want to have sex with my mammy. That's what it's all about, yeah.
I'm going to throw my rock on the crick.
What's going on in the world today, I'd say one of the few things that's really potentially very interesting, and this will be a topic of one of the future Warner shows, is this kind of increasing, like turning up the volume notch by notch, multilateral standoff in the South China Sea. And one day we should probably just do a show about that, but we seem to be ramping up a little bit, and then China ramps it up a little bit, and there's a little bit more, you know, panic out there from some of the nearby countries. And it seems like we're starting to really itch for a showdown, and China might be too. So maybe that's for a future right. show, though. Yeah. The only other thing, and this will segue into the Yemen shows. I just want to read a story from yesterday, I believe it, from Military Times, and the headline is "U.S. Boots on the Ground." How they love that one. It sounds like Michael Weiss. I know. U.S. boots on the ground in Yemen will be quote short term unquote. And it leads off, despite a string of victories over al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a team of U.S. troops on the ground in Yemen will remain in place for now, a top Pentagon official said. The deployment is, quote, short term, unquote, but currently has no firm end date. I like that. It's short term, but has no end date. The, quote, small contingent, unquote, of U.S. forces was deployed there in April to support Arab-led forces' effort to oust the militant group al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula from their stronghold in the Yemeni port of al-Mukalla, I guess that's pronounced. Mm. They're still in country, still providing that liaison role, particularly in support of intelligence sharing. Now, of course, we know that there are all kinds of Anglo world mercenaries working with the Saudis there, and as well as official military and intelligence people on the operation. So, yeah. This is usually how it starts, right? So I guess maybe we want to get to know this war a bit.
That's the thing. The front on which these people are fighting isn't even supposed to be happening, really. There's supposed to be a war between... There's supposed to be a sectarian war between the Shia of northwestern Yemen and the Saudi-supported Sunni of the Indian Ocean coast around Aden and up... a little bit inland from there. But what these guys are talking about is what's happening east of all that in what's a mostly uninhabited desert, where the vacuum left by the complete weakness of the Saudi coalition has created perfect place for Islamic State style irregulars. I'm not saying Islamic State because it's just a franchise name, but people who believe roughly the same thing as Islamic State, Sunni, Salafi militants, have organized against both the Shia and the Saudi-supported Sunni government in Aden. So now we're trying to help our incompetent sectarian Saudi friends save their proxies in Yemen from the people who've taken their own Saudi Wahhabism a little too seriously and are now actually trying to carry it out. It's grotesque. I can't think of any other word for it.
It almost reminds me a little bit of the Republicans going for Trump. It's like the Republicans have been working all this, their electorate base into a froth, you know, all these decades, the last three, four decades, where Trump's politics are theirs, except that they've been faking it. I mean, the donors and the people backing it all have been faking it to try to mobilize these guys to vote for them so that they can cut taxes and cut, you know, EPA regulations, whatever, you know, antitrust regulations. And now they've gotten away from them. the scum, the bastard, the lowlifes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the hatred that Republican elite is showing for its loyal
fans. You're
lucky
we gave you democracy in the first place, you pigs. Yeah.
And it was a mistake. Some of them are saying right now it was a mistake. Andrew Sullivan invoking Plato the way crypto fascists always do when the mob does something to annoy them. Like Plato was right in the first place. These primates, these primitive screwheads, these primates should not be allowed near our boomsticks.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, I one last thing about Andrew Sullivan's piece, and I hope to never talk about him again, but he invokes Plato, and Plato, of course, in Republic talks about, he's basically says, democracy's fails because it turns into some kind of tyranny. And what you really need is sort of a Politburo philosopher kings. And then my memory of this, I'm so goddamn long ago, but I took a class with David Cohen, who was a Plato expert, a rhetoric of Plato expert. And my memory of it is that Plato later renounced that because he became an advisor in some nasty internecine war in Sicily. I think one of the Syracuse tyrants who had adopted Plato's teachings and hired him as an advisor, and then wound up imposing something like a mini Pol Pot regime there. And then Plato fled, by the skin of his teeth, and basically said, I was wrong.
That just means Plato had the original Republican epiphany, It's when they get caught that they suddenly discover the drug laws are really kind of unfair. And it's when Duke Cunningham ends up doing 5 years in a federal pen that he realizes prisons are just unfair things and they're mean. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a Plato fan myself. I'm a sophist fan from way back. And that seems like the sort of contemptible nonsense he would say with the typical arrogant, abstracted indifference to what's really going on and search for something that will satisfy his demand for pure essence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we've dispensed with Plato on the show, moving on. So let's get back to Yemen here. As you say, the current war, I mean, you can't really place it. I mean, it's hard to place it. Was it in the Arab Spring when it hit Yemen in 2011, or was it when the Houthi wound up really becoming a noticeable problem when they took Sana'a a couple of years ago? So why don't you get into the start or the inability to really point your finger at the start?
Yeah, I mean, Yemen is not a country with a peaceful history. It's not a country with a culture that tends to venerate peace as some particularly desirable state. And I don't think that's particularly unusual in world terms either. But there's been war in Yemen pretty continuously. The only people who succeeded in imposing a period of something like peace in Yemen were the British, who were extremely good at this sort of thing. I mean, they managed to keep Yemen fairly calm for the first half of the 20th century. But other empires, such as the Ottoman Empire, tried to do so and failed completely. And then in the 1960s, Yemen became a forgotten but really important battleground for the future of the Arab world, whether it would be ruled by secular socialist intellectuals who at that time represented southern Yemen, or whether it would be represented by a divinely inspired monarchy, which was the standard of northern Yemen. And Nasser and the Arab nationalists, and remember, Nasser once joked about how silly it would be to put women back in veils. Nasser was a modernizer among his other characteristics. He was backing the socialists, secularists in Yemen, but a lot of other bigger, badder people were backing the fight for Allah and the Emir. When I was looking this up, I actually found an old Time magazine article from the 1960s, which talked with quaint fondness about how these Yemenis were fighting for Allah and the Emir. And in the 60s, that sounded just, aw, aren't they cute? Now, that's the only fight there is. The other people were lost. So Yemen has always been a battleground, and within the last century, it's been a battleground that mattered a great deal and which ended really badly. But in the meantime, these sides changed their not so much their core beliefs as their role in the region. So the northern Yemeni Shia, who had been the backers of this divinely inspired king against the socialists, are now the enemies of the Saudis, who have their own divinely inspired king. And they decided that they were sick of Saudi encroachment and Sunni encroachment on their homeland, which was the highlands of northwestern Yemen. And they began fighting. And the interesting thing about this is they started fighting in 2004. And about 7 years later, I was in Najran, just across the border in Saudi Arabia. And I mean across the border from the very heartland of the Houthi insurgency. Mm-hmm. But I've asked people about who were there, and as far as any of us can remember, none of us even knew the name of the province across the border. No one ever crossed that border. It was a mile-high cliffs, for one thing. But also, even if there had been a road there, no one ever crossed that border. It was a line that the Saudis held as if the walking dead lived on the other side of it, because they considered armed Shia a dangerous force. Najran itself used to be part of Yemen. They had bought it from the impoverished Yemen with their oil money, or rather leased it. And when the time came to pay back the lease, they said, no, we're rich. We got the Americans on our side. You Yemenis can go to hell. That's why Najran is still in Saudi Arabia.
I see.
So this is a long, long fight between the highland Shia of the southwest of the peninsula and the Wahhabi of the center of the peninsula, the Arabian Peninsula.
So I'm sorry to interrupt. So this means that when Nasser came in to support the North, the Republican coup revolution.
To support the South, actually. Yeah.
Wait, I thought Nasser was with the North. Okay.
No, that's the thing. The North is Shia now, but in those days they were royalists. They were the religious one.
Okay.
The South is now every bit as insanely religious as the North, but that was not the case back then. They talked socialism, like a lot of Arab
rebels. I remember that was always, because usually when we had enemies, communist enemies, it was always in the North, North Vietnam, North Korea,
and
our allies, corrupt allies, were always the South. And I always remember with Yemen, it was kind of switched around.
Our corrupt allies were basically the Saudis who were in the North of the whole thing. Yeah, so I mean, you can go back to the 17th century here. I mean, that's when the Ottomans got their asses kicked in Yemen. This has always been a big battleground, an important battleground. But I just decided, let's just pick a date. March 2015, that's when the Saudi Air Force, very expensive, very high-tech Air Force, started bombing Yemen. I mean, so let's see what led up to that. Yemen has always had these three parts, basically. The Shia Highlands that we're talking about, the northwest, the Indian Ocean coast, which is mostly Sunni, and then the desert to the east, and deserts in the Arabian Peninsula are always good recruiting ground for Wahhabism. So these have always been places that people were willing to fight over, because there are a lot of ports. There's a lot of trees that produce aromatic gum. And by the way, one of the people we met in Cambodia here actually sells aromatic gums from Cambodian trees to make oud, which is sold in the Arabian Peninsula. So even now, these aromatic gums are a big, big deal. It's weird.
Wait, what do they use it for?
To make Saudi and Kuwaiti malls uninhabitable, because they sell them in these very expensive shops that, you know, they call it oud, and they blast the perfume out of the shops. And I swear to you, Catherine and I used to see, oh God, that's an oud shop, and we'd speed up our pace and go past, because it's like a combination of a house burning down that somebody had tried to put out the fire with perfume. That's the only way I can describe the smell. But it's very popular. Apparently some trees that grow here in Cambodia are part of the deal. But anyway, that was one of the things that made Yemen possible. But the big, big thing, especially for the Turks, is coffee. Mocha is a port in Yemen, and Mocha for a while was the only place that was producing coffee for export. Right. So the Ottomans came in, and the reason they thought Yemen would be easy to take is really interesting, because it's the same reason the Saudis think now that Yemen will be easy to take. This is a quote from an Ottoman vizier in the 16th century. Quote, "Yemen is a land with no lord, an empty province. It would be not only possible, but easy to capture. And should it be captured, it would be master of the lands of India and send every year a great amount of gold and jewels to Constantinople." I mean, it sounds like Iraq.
Kenneth Edelman, yeah. The Ottomans had their own Kenneth Edelman, all right.
How do you say cakewalk in Turkish? Yeah, because the Ottomans sent 80,000 soldiers to Yemen to claim this land with no lord. 7,000 of them survived. 73,000 died.
Wow.
And at least the Ottomans had the grace to admit they were wrong, unlike a certain Bush administration we won't name. They had a comment a few years later, quote, "We have seen no foundry like Yemen for our soldiers. Each time we have sent an expeditionary force, it has melted away like salt dissolved in water."
That's a great analogy. I'm going to use that.
Yeah. Yeah, you send these hard crystals in and suddenly they're gone. And they could not understand this. They were allowed to leave from Mocha, allowed to sail out of Mocha in 1634. That is allowed by these Shia, who they thought of as disorganized, lordless nobodies.
That's kind of what they say about them today, in a sense, too, though, isn't it? That they're disorganized and, yeah.
Yep. Because they didn't understand the whole imam theory of organization in certain Shia societies. It's very unlike the Sunni caliphate idea, where there is a lord and he is the secular lord and he decides every day who gets punished for what. The Shia idea in northwestern Yemen was a little different. And you see it in other places now. You see it with Sadr in Iraq, who's a Shia imam, basically. You see it with Nasrallah in Shia Lebanon. The idea is they stay above day-to-day politics. They don't take part in ordinary administrations and law giving and all that. But when someone invades, the imam steps forward and mobilizes all the fighting clans to unite against the invader. And when he does that, he can become suddenly very effective. And the Ottomans, with their totally hierarchical, almost Inca-like pyramidal system, could not understand that at all. That's what's happening now again.
Right.
So the Houthi are just a clan, a powerful family in northwestern Lebanon, just over the border from Najran.
Northwestern
Yemen, just over the border from Najran. They nominated one of their clan as their leader against the Sunni domination from Aden and their Saudi sponsors. He was killed. But there's not a lot of use in killing one member of a clan, because there are about 27 cousins who can step forward. Once in a while you get someone of unusual abilities, but usually not. Usually whoever the replacement is, it's pretty good facsimile. They were struck by these Saudi sponsors because we're living through a Sunni revival, and the Saudis, as its sponsors, have been pushing hard against old Shia enemies, including the Yemeni. And when they were struck, they stopped being disorganized and they struck back. And when you look at the timeline of the Houthi response, it's really interesting. I mean, you want to see what led up to the Saudi air strikes. And it has to do with old patterns of attack. When the Shia gets strong, they tend to move south towards Sana'a. And if they're even stronger, they move toward Aden, even right on the Indian Ocean coast. If they're really strong, they strike north toward Najran into the Saudi heartland. So if you look at what happened just before the Saudis felt they had to start sending planes, September 2014, the Houthi take Sana'a, scaring the hell out of the Saudis. That's the capital city in the hills. March 25th, 2015, they come close enough that the Saudi-sponsored president, Hadi, sails out of Aden and ends up in Saudi Arabia. One day later, March 26th, Saudi Air Force starts bombing Yemen. And one way you can tell how closely the Saudis cooperate with U.S. military is the names they gave this operation. The U.S. has the worst military poets in the world, and the Saudis are right up there with them. They called it Operation Decisive Storm. What the hell is a decisive storm, anyway?
It sounds kind of like Desert Storm.
Yes, that's right. I knew there was. Yeah, yeah.
Decisive storm. Wow, that must have been suggested by one of their American hirelings.
Yes,
it's just. Or an American trained Saudi, and then the Americans all said, yes, sounds good.
Well, they share a lot of culture. I mean, when we were in Kuwait, Catherine was training Kuwaiti officers who knew the street layout of some Texas cities as well as they knew Kuwait City. In fact, a hell of a lot better than they knew the poor quarters of Kuwait City, where they would never go on a bet. So yeah, there's a lot of shared culture between Saudi Air Force pilots and U.S. Air Force brass. And they did a very typically American thing too. They bombed for 1 month under Desert Storm, but that term storm, you know,
decisive
it's a little storm. Yeah, decisive, right? Decisive storm. It's a little too aggressive. So after 1 month, they changed it to, my favorite, Operation Restoring Hope. Doc, get in the cellar. The Saudis are restoring hope.
So they went from the Bush to the Obama slogan. You know,
yes.
Crazy.
In 1 month. Yeah. I don't know if they have like a lieutenant colonel who's in charge of military poetry for these things. But anyway, yeah, they didn't stop bombing anybody. Yep. Operation Ask a Taxi Driver. They didn't stop any policies. They were still bombing anything that moved. But they gave it that, yeah, as you say, very Obama, very positive, restoring hope change. And the Saudis, as an American-influenced military, have a lot of faith in air power. And one of the things we'll see as we talk about this is, and this is sort of our dramatic question, stay tuned after the commercial break, were they right? Would air power alone make a difference?
Stay tuned to find out.
Yeah. And to make sure they had plenty of air power, they hired... And, you know, let's be honest, they just hired the air forces of Egypt, Morocco, Jordan, Sudan, the UAE, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, all those outposts of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And they hit the Shia areas of Yemen very, very hard. They could not bear the idea of the Shia controlling the capital, Sana'a. So
Sudan. I'm sorry, that just kind of hit me. Yeah. Sudan.
Yes, wow. Sudan. I guess there was a lull in Darfur. No villages left.
It also just shows that Sudan, which is supposedly was a big pariah state for us, officially owes everything to the Saudis. They owe them a billion favors. And, well, you know, it's an open secret, but yeah, okay.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, the Saudis declared, for example, every inch of Sada province, the one just across from Najran, where the Houthi came from, every inch of that province was a legitimate target for bombing. Wow. They hit markets, they hit hospitals. A month after they started bombing, they actually bombed the Sana'a runways in order to stop the Red Crescent from sending medical aid to Sana'a.
Right, because it's not like the Houthis had an air force.
No, they have no air force at all.
Yeah.
And that's why this is such an interesting test case. The Houthi have nothing resembling an air force. In fact, they don't even have surface-to-air missiles. There was a really interesting case a couple of months ago. The American media printed it proudly, like U.S. naval vessel stops arms ship.
Oh, right.
And it was an arms shipment from probably from Iran to the Houthi in Yemen. But what the story didn't report it without really understanding is the arms that they were in the hold of this ship were AK-47s, RPG-7s, machine guns, ammunition. That was all.
Mm-hmm.
That is like bare bones weaponry. And they have nothing that can stop a Saudi or UAE F-16. You're not going to shoot that down with an RPG or a machine gun. It's just not going to happen. Unless you have missiles, you don't have a chance. And even with missiles, you don't have much of a chance. But they have nothing. So it should have been, you know, a walkover, a cakewalk, in fact. And the Saudis certainly did a lot of killing. They bombed Hajja market just a couple of months ago, killed 100 civilians. These were all excellent planes. These are pilots who've trained in Texas. And the interesting thing is, to answer the question we put before the commercial, it failed completely.
Hmm.
The control map of Yemen right now looks a lot like it did just before the Saudis started bombing. And that is really astonishing.
Mm-hmm. The only thing they seem to have taken back was somewhat is Aden, right? The port.
Yeah, they've got Aden, and they needed that.
Yeah.
But they have not made any inroads in northwestern Shia control. And worse yet, it's now, as we were saying, a three-sided war. Because while they've been focusing on killing the Shia in the northwest, AQAP, Al-Qaeda, Arabian Peninsula, and Islamic State, and every other freelance Islamist has been starting up little fan clubs in the desert. And now those fan clubs are attacking Sunni, Saudi-sponsored troops in Aden. So it's been a total disaster. We have seen an amazing demonstration of how useless air forces are when you don't have infantry to consolidate the gains. I mean, we've seen something like that in Lebanon because the Russian Air Force is extremely powerful, extremely good. But it hasn't progressed as quickly as I think the Russians expected to because there isn't enough good infantry.
Mm-hmm. In Syria, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, in Syria. Yeah, yeah. But this is much, much worse. I mean, there's just no good infantry there. So the Saudis know this because their American advisors are telling this. So where do you get infantry to help out your expensive air force? And the answer is you buy it. And that's where the mercenaries come in. Mm. And that's the next big development here.
Well, I was going to say also that if you already have a somewhat demoralized force that's already been losing, and then suddenly these rich neighbors come in, and you might have already a lot of very mixed feelings about them, even if they're coming there to save your hide, they're neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's not like the Russians to Syrians where there's a lot of distance between them. They're neighbors. Right. So you already might have that. I mean, having an expensive air force where no one flying those planes can possibly, you know, so much as stub their toe or hurt their pinky, it might in a way also disincentivize you from doing the dirty work on the ground for them. You know, it might make you resentful or might make you think, well, they can take care of it. I mean, why would I die? You know,
that's
fighting
true.
These guys now. So it can be a mixed blessing in that way. Right. I mean, you need a really motivated ground force.
That's true. I think we've seen that with a lot of American allies. Like, okay, you guys want to do this? Yeah, go to it. You know, go get them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll sit back here and criticize your airstrikes. Yeah. Nah, you missed there.
Call yourself an Air Force. Hold on, the jiffy pop's almost done. Hold on.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I mean, and these were never very good troops. I mean, to be honest, the Shia were always the stronger troops in Yemen. So what the Saudis have done and the United Emirates have done, because the UAE is also getting really ambitious militarily, they hired this amazing sort of like the ancient Persian Empire army of mercenaries, or the Carthaginian Empire of mercenaries. They hired Australian SAS guys, like this guy Michael Hind Marsh, who is now the commander of the United Arab Emirates Presidential Guard, which is fighting in Yemen.
Hmm.
His annual salary is $500,000 a year, tax-free, which has got to beat Australian civil service rates, even if there is free medical care. Right. I mean, you could another officer from the Australian SAS, Kevin Dolan. Oh, yeah, we get around. Where there's sleaze, we're there. There's all these Irish Australians, Scott Corrigan, all these Irish Australian SAS types. I think you mentioned that Montgomery McFate's ex is now the big champion of mercenary forces, right?
Right, right.
And there's all this rhetoric about that too now, like why mercenaries are so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So one of these experts said in his article, it's the same business, whether for your original state or a new one. A good general can end a war faster and save lives. So we see that mercenaries are actually in the business of saving lives. A real NRA-worthy argument.
Mm. It's funny, the rhetoric of this stuff. I mean, this practice didn't come about because intellectuals sat and thought real hard and thought, you know, this is it came about for various legalistic, you know, trying to avoid accountability because governments couldn't do certain things. And because, you know, in the revolving door, there were a lot of people who saw another way of making money. If you could just privatize this and privatize that. And then you need some mandarins to come in and make it sound great and cool and new and the future. It's always got to be the future. You know, yep. Then people kind of won't argue against it as much. So, yeah, you get Sean McFate and this guy. And now people are starting to kind of repeat the same blather. Oh, well, this is the way of the future, without even knowing why they're repeating these received ideas.
They sound like a bunch of whataboutists to me.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
what about Carthage?
Yeah, that's right. What about Carthage? Huh? Why didn't they take Rome if they were? Yeah. So the interesting thing about the UAE hiring all these mercenaries is originally the UAE sent its own troops there because the UAE has nominal conscription. Like it reminds me very much of teaching Saudi high school students. If you finish high school in the UAE, you only have to serve 6 months or something. But if you don't finish high school and you don't do your homework, you'll have to do a full year or something in the military.
Mm.
Not that it's going to be really hard duty. So they sent these ordinary UAE, high school dropouts to Yemen, but then 45 of them got killed by a Houthi missile strike.
Wow.
And the UAE has a small population.
Yeah.
They do not like casualties. So suddenly, boom, okay, we got to hire foreigners because nobody cares if they get killed.
Yeah.
So they hired Australian SAS officers, but the weirdest thing, there's so many weird things about this war. One of the weirdest things about the other hires is that they're mostly from Latin America. They hired Colombian special forces, mm-hmm. Mexican special forces, Argentine special forces. There are apparently at least 2,000 Colombian mercenaries working for the UAE. And nobody knows how many of them are fighting in Yemen, but probably a lot. And you know, Colombian special forces are scary people.
Yes, yes. And they've been I'm thinking back to some old articles, including an article that Yasha Levine wrote for The Exile, I remember, about this former Israeli, very top military intelligence guy who was arrested in Russia. And he had run these sort of mercenary training camps on some Caribbean islands for right-wing paramilitaries. So they already had this kind of semi-privatized mercenary thing going on there because right-wing landowners and oligarchs and companies, oil companies, Coca-Cola, I mean, this is, you know, this goes way back. They would hire these guys privately. Maybe you don't want the actual army to be involved in the massacres and the killings of left-wingers or peasant leaders or union leaders. So, yeah,
you never know who might have a cousin who was, you know, one of the bodies you were throwing into the railway car. Right. Whereas if you get somebody from far away, they're less likely to care. Yeah, the United Fruit Company mercenary theory. But the Colombians, you know, there's this interesting thing called Fuerzas Comando, which is a tournament. And I have to admit, it sounds kind of cool in a video game way, where elite teams from lots of Western Hemisphere countries, including the U.S., compete. You know, U.S. Delta Force, Colombian Special Forces, Mexican, Argentine, all these special forces compete to see who does the best at, you know, I don't know, a hostage scenario or an assassination scenario or something. Colombians have won those 7 out of the last 10 times.
Wow.
So they're really good. And also, they're not known for being squeamish. I mean, let's be honest here.
Anyone who's seen Scarface knows the shower chainsaw scene. Yeah.
Well, and then, you know, that was a very dirty war they were fighting in Colombia against various left-wing groups. And there's a big overlap between official Colombian military and right-wing paramilitary. So a lot of those guys probably have backgrounds in both of those things. So they were hired for this country, for Yemen, even though they, you know, probably hadn't thought much about Yemen before. And the money is incredible, just like the money that you know, some not particularly bright Blackwater recruit was getting in Iraq. Some of those guys were making $1,000 a day in Iraq. Colombian privates from the special forces can make $90 a day in Yemen, whereas they make $370 a month in Colombia. An English-speaking officer from the Colombian special forces can get hired in Yemen and make $250 a day. And the Colombian officer in charge of recruitment for special forces said out loud, "Hey, we can't compete with Abu Dhabi." I mean, there aren't that many people who can, you know. Mm-hmm. So there are all kinds of Colombians now fighting in Yemen. There were also a lot of Blackwater forces, probably including a lot of American mercenaries. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like Blackwater withdrew because mercenary companies don't really like taking casualties. And something like 45 of them were killed in a single attack, a missile attack, in Lahij province along the Red Sea coastline. So it may be that the Colombian mercenaries are more willing to take casualties than Blackwater. I don't know if there's a lawsuit culture in Colombia, but often for these companies, it comes down to that. You want to hire mercenaries from places that don't have a lawsuit culture. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Blackwater's still dealing with, I believe, lawsuits over some of the massacres in Iraq.
Yep.
And other messes. So, yeah. And on top of it, Blackwater, I mean, geez, you know, what a bang-up job they did protecting Benazir Bhutto. Like, how did you guys ever get a gig again after that, you know?
I don't know. I mean, that really is one of the mysteries of this era. How come these guys still have jobs? How come these guys still
get... Like, you're thinking military... I almost, in a weird, sick way, get it why absolute failures in journalism and punditry keep getting jobs because, I don't know, nobody's... because they're all in it together, I don't know. But in the military, I mean, we're talking about dying. Is the consequence of immediately dying? So, and protecting yourself. So you wouldn't want to. You would actually want to hire a failure liar to do propaganda for you because he or she has you know, no conscience and no brain, and they'll do whatever you want. But you don't want to hire a brainless failure loser to protect your life, I would think.
No, I don't really understand it myself. I mean, that's not the nature of these wars. You don't go in and blast everything in sight the way Blackwater people did in Iraq and the way mercenaries tend to do. It just doesn't work. And anybody with half a brain knows that. But the trouble is, I hear from people in the U.S. military now that the really brief vogue that counterinsurgency theory had when Dr. McFate was on the rise, it's gone now.
Yes.
And the whole theory now is blast them, kill them. No talking, no languages, just going in blast.
It's thought that a Hillary Clinton presidency would probably give COIN another go.
I'm sure she'll pick the wrong version of it somehow.
Yes. she did a bang up job in Libya, so
yeah, that's true. If there's one really small time place where you actually could have handled things, that would have been it, and they managed to mess it up completely. So when you look back at what's happening in Yemen, you're seeing some really interesting trends here. First of all, the limits, to put it mildly, of air power on its own. Air power has probably had a worse effect than not intervening at all, because there have been a lot of dead civilians who have a lot of angry relatives, and it hasn't really changed the battlefield at all. That's not to say that all air power is equally useless. The Russian air power in Syria, which was coordinated with local people in a smart way, has done some good. But air power with no infantry power behind it, like we see in Yemen, total failure. But there's also a geopolitical angle that's really interesting here. And this is where a lot of people don't see what their own lifetime represents in historical terms. We're living through the Sunni revival. That's the biggest thing happening in the world right now, aside from the fact that the planet is dying. And there's been no pushback against Sunni power until very recently. I mean, 10 years ago, Prince Bandar, a very popular Saudi prince in Washington, D.C. circles, was telling the Bushes, you know, there are a billion Sunni, and they're getting very tired of these Shia, and one of these days we are going to get rid of them. And I'm sure that got polite nods from his friends in D.C. And it really looked like it was going that way. Mm. Like Sunni power was getting stronger and stronger. There was not a lot of pushback. And what we're beginning to see now, it seems like, is the start of Shia pushback in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Yemen. The Iranians, if we're going to use them as the source of Shia power, which is an oversimplification, have fought with much more intelligence and finesse than the Saudis. They don't jump in with both feet the way the Saudis do. They don't rely on sheer firepower the way the Saudis do. In fact, an Iranian Revolutionary Guards officer in Syria said when the Saudis threatened to intervene in Syria, oh, I wish they would. They have an old-style conventional army, and they would be slaughtered here. Mm. And it's really true, because the Iranians go in with people they know they can trust. They wear the local uniforms. They work with the local units. They not only call themselves advisors, they actually act like advisors with very small combat groups here and there. And it works. The Saudi method, go send an expensive airplane that we already bought from the Americans, it does not work. So we're beginning to see maybe this big Shia pushback. And that's where the most fun story of this whole thing, it's one I wrote about for Pando a while ago, is the mosque and madrasa complex called Darul al-Hadith. This was an extraordinary event, a kind of crusader castle in terms of the Shia-Sunni fight. It's in Sa'da province, just south of Najran. This is the heartland of Shia Yemen. There was a guy, Wadi was his name, and he was born Shia. He had some grudge with his people. He wandered north to Najran, went into a Sunni mosque that the of the kind that the Saudis have paid tons to install there, got converted to Sunni Islam, came back to this little Shia town by a stream called Damaj, and started a gigantic Sunni mosque as a sectarian provocation. And this was in 1979. I swear to God, there are certain years that matter.
Yes.
1979 is the year that happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Shia were so weak at that time that they let this happen, even though it was meant as a provocation. The Sunni were so strong, the Saudi were so strong, the Saudi were pouring money into this. And who knows, maybe the local villagers were happy to, you know, have a little money, and they were willing to tolerate a little heresy.
Mm-hmm.
And Darul al-Hadith, this madrasa, started drawing Somali-American kids from Minneapolis, started drawing Turkish, German kids from Dusseldorf. It started drawing kids from everywhere. Mm. And there's even a blog that was written by somebody who lived there, a Somali-American from Minneapolis. And I've read this thing, and it's touching and annoying, and a lot of other things by paragraphs, you know. Typical Salafi, as the ones I've seen. Ordinary, middle-of-the-curve guy, kind of conservative, kind of authoritarian, not a lot of imagination, believes in rules. That's about it. But not a monster, just kind of a Boy Scout in a very annoying way. Mm-hmm. So this guy writes about being in Darul al-Hadith. And they have, like, the most hilarious blood-soaked town versus gown thing going in the history of the world, because the town is Shia, the province is Shia, but the madrasa is Sunni, and all these Sunni kids from all over the world who are sectarians to the bone are sitting inside this madrasa in the heart of Houthi territory. And this lasted all through the end of the 20th century. And finally, a few years ago, as the Hadi, the corrupt prime minister backed by the Saudis, was trying to save his skin, he finally did a deal with the Houthi, said, okay, you can have Darul al-Hadith. And you read the blogs by these innocent authoritarian kids who were manning the walls with their AKs, trying to fight for the Sunnah. And they just can't believe that one of their own guys would betray them like this. It's like some weird 21st century children's crusade, only they're a little more willing to shoot back than the children's crusade people were. But they get booted out. They have no sense of the corruption of this. I mean, they're writing in American English about, you know, it's pretty cool here, although it's a little different from back home, LOL. I mean, I couldn't get used to the scorpions, LOL, LOL.
Wink, wink, wink.
Yeah. Wow. And that lasted for many years. It was almost like a scientific experiment. Mm-hmm. Stevens has a poem, "I placed a jar in Tennessee, mm-hmm. ground it was upon a hill. It did not give of bird or bush like nothing else in Tennessee." And it was like that. You place a Sunni madrasa right in the middle of the Shia territory, and you see how long it lasts. And it lasted a long time. But just as the Houthis started moving south and shelling Najran, it fell. And it was almost like a canary coal mine scenario. It was like that is the moment when the pushback was clearly starting to happen.
Mm. Interesting.
And the third factor in all of this is that as the Saudi weakness has been revealed, and if there's one country that can misuse its air power and pick even lousier allies than the U.S., it's definitely Saudi. As they got weaker and weaker, their rather limited military forces focused north and west against the Houthi, and meanwhile, behind them, the jihadis are starting to appear.
Mm-hmm.
And the jihadis started out by attacking Shia, because that's always a good, you know, way of getting the guys excited, all the 18-year-old psychos. So they killed a couple of hundred people in Sana'a by bombing Shia mosques. That was in fall of 2015. But now, in a very typical way, they're not so much interested in doing that. They're interested in killing Saudi coalition fighters in Aden. They've been doing suicide attacks on Saudi and UAE and mercenary troops in Aden. They call themselves various things, Islamic State, AQAP. You know, there's a lot of hysteria about this. Just because you call yourself Islamic State doesn't mean you get a special decoder ring or something with it. They have basically the same idea, and that's what it comes down to. And the Sunni strength right now, once again, is shown not to be conventional military armies, which Sunni countries seem to do very badly for some reason, but suicide militias like these, because they are now the third party in this fight, and they're the second strongest. The Houthi are the strongest, then these Islamic State people, with the Saudi proxies looking very weak and probably collapse completely if it weren't for their mercenaries.
So why now? Why are the Salafists, who obviously, you know, take their original inspiration from the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, why are they now focusing all of their military, you know, force on the coalition, on the Saudi-led coalition?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I don't claim to know completely. I think a lot of stuff probably goes into it. One of the things is propinquity. I mean, they're there because they're there. They're in the same territory.
Right.
And because when you're an 18-year-old suicide commando, Saudi proxies seem, and in fact are, rather weak, compromised people, and they're in your way.
And remember what Gunnar said, and even like what Bin Laden used to say. I mean, it's the corrupt who are the biggest enemies. The Shia need to be exterminated, but the real enemies are the corrupt regimes, the corrupt Arab regimes. And so I guess this is like a Justice League. The coalition is a Justice League of corrupt Sunni regimes, right?
Yes, exactly.
So they would. I mean, I guess if you tried to put yourself in their mindset, I could see why.
Yeah. Yeah.
They prove their purity by killing them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and they've had their chance, basically. A lot of jihadism, and this part, I have to admit, I understand and sympathize with, a lot of it comes from humiliation. I mean, there haven't been a lot of victories for Sunni, especially Sunni Arab armies in recent decades. And yet Islamic State and briefly Al-Qaeda projected the image of real power and complete courage. And it makes more sense to be aligned with something like that, even if you're not as numerous or as well-funded, than something that stands for, WASTA, which is an Arabic word you hear all the time, meaning nepotism, influence peddling, corruption in general.
And I think it's also a sign of how weak, as you already said, anyway, how weak the local Saudi proxy forces are, the government forces there, that they'd be getting their asses kicked by the Al-Qaeda groups. And the other thing, too, I would think, is that our drone war in Yemen, and I think that's been, besides Pakistan, that's been sort of ground zero for the U.S. Drone wars since 2002. And we've targeted the Al-Qaeda groups there, so so they're probably pretty pissed off already.
Yeah, and legitimized.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things about being droned by the U.S. is you are a shahada after that. You are a martyr. I mean, it clearly made you a martyr. The U.S. is obviously not droning the Saudi proxies, and the fact that the Saudi proxies are so close to the U.S. and they're flying American planes and dropping American bombs. It's not exactly a big recruiting factor with, you know, the Arab street.
Right, right. That makes sense. So now the Saudis have tried to get a ceasefire, or talked about anyway. They're talking now, ceasefire, you know. Yeah. Whoa, 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 whoa.
Well, we've been hitting you guys pretty hard. Maybe we'll let up now.
That's... You had enough?
It has not been a very impressive display of military power, and yet the Houthi, who have apparently very limited weaponry, are much better adapted to a defensive war in hilly terrain than they are to swarming north under those Saudi planes, because, you know, once you get across that mountain wall into Najran, even an Air Force only force can find you on the road, big dust clouds, and just destroy you. So it's hard to see them swarming north. They've made a few incursions. They've shelled Najran. In fact, the interesting thing is, I hear from people who I taught with there that they've closed down the campus of the preparatory year where I taught, because it's in Najran, and it was getting mortared too much. And it's a very funny Najrani story. So apparently now they drive out to this gigantic, God knows how many billion-dollar new campus that the Saudi government built further away from the Yemeni border. And they do their teaching there. But then once the teaching day is over, because the Saudis did not build any housing at this gigantic, expensive new campus, everybody drives back into town in Najran and sort of waits out the time until their next shift. And if they get mortared while they're off duty, you know, well, you know, that's kind of their problem. But wow. They will at least not get mortared at the campus because it's out of mortar range.
Wow. That's messed up. Yeah. Well, and then it seems like within Saudi Arabia, I mean, this would be for another show, but there's a lot of, it's a bit of internal turmoil at the top between, you know, the new king and princes. And I mean, Prince Bandar is no longer apparently in power. I mean, and of course, the collapse of oil would be feeding a lot of this as well. I mean, the collapse of oil prices, and it's still, it's not returning, and it doesn't look like the oil price is going to return anytime soon. So yeah, this would exacerbate any of the confusion or the panic that's going on in the Saudi regime.
Yeah, and I have no idea where that will go. I mean, the new king had a reputation when I was there. He wasn't in power yet, but as in all completely authoritarian state, everybody's hobby is predicting what the next ruler will be like. Mm-hmm. And everybody, all the expats said, he doesn't like expats. He doesn't like foreign influence. And he wants them out. So he was supposedly more hardline than what's his name?
It looks like he is, but I thought the thing was that he was supposed to be more of a reformer because he let like 10 women drive a car or something. His PR people have been making it seem like he's taking steps towards reform. I mean, you've been hearing that story for decades now. And,
you know, yeah.
Something happens, they only cut off half a head, and so it's real reform now.
Yeah, and all those Saudi women stories, as we had occasion to learn in Najran, they apply to the top 1% of the Saudi female population, the elite of Riyadh. That stuff means nothing at all in the streets of a town, a provincial town like Najran, which as an heretical Shia town is under especially heavy police presence. I mean, it was, you not only could not drive as a woman in Najran, you couldn't walk down the street no matter how completely you covered yourself. So those stories are really irritating if you've actually lived there. I mean, you have to wonder if the reporters have spent any time there and or if they're just reporting Saudi nonsense on their own. Because it's, I don't know, it's kind of like Hillary times 1,000. You know, what, when she thinks she's fighting for women, she's fighting for maybe a very few women who are locked into the corporate hierarchy already. But the rest don't have a lot of stake in what she's doing, and that's even more true for this Saudi stuff.
Yeah, well, news bureaus don't want to get kicked out of Saudi Arabia, so right. they'll soft pedal it, and it doesn't win them any friends in Washington or New York to get kicked out. Unlike some other countries, you get kicked out, you're a hero. But yeah, no, you never hear the story set in a larger context of women can't even walk on the same street with a man. Women can't do this and that and this. It's only can they drive or not drive, and then it shows one or two women on Facebook talking about how they're about to drive, and it really it gives you a really false impression of we're on the verge of something progressive there.
That's the only possible narrative. In fact, when you look back at the last 30 years, you can see that the Western media was just not prepared for the idea that history does not go in just one direction, and that it can decide the hell with this, we're going back. And that's really what the year 1979 means, everywhere from the U.S. to Pakistan, that decision, the hell with this, we're going back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, and on that note, I think, the last question would be, I mean, where do you see it going? I know predictions are always awful, as anybody following, trying to predict what was going to happen in this election in the U.S. we could even tell you. So, in a foreign country, it's even harder to predict. But where do you see things going in Yemen for the Saudis, for the Houthis, and so on?
It seems like a stalemate, and that means something like de facto federation. I mean, Yemen was divided into two countries on Shia-Sunni north-south lines until 1990, I think. And it could easily end up being divided that way again, either de facto or officially, because there isn't the military power on either side to change that. The thing that's changed since then is what's happening in the East, the freelancers, the jihadis. And that would mean that it could end up with the Saudi proxies being the meat in the sandwich, as they say in New Zealand, and just getting chomped, so that it would be divided not between Shia and Sunni, but Shia and Islamists. That is Sunni squared.
Right. You notice how, and it's when it comes to this point that it suddenly stops being a media story. Kind of like Libya, Libya, we were going to free them, and Gaddafi was just the evil tyrant and so on. Things went really bad. This is the one area where you can say in a cold, cynical way that the Obama administration has been smarter than the Bush administration, which wanted to crow about its victory and do dirty chicken dances and have people come and film it all. When the Obama administration screws something up badly, they just try to point the camera somewhere else really quickly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been researching this story pretty hard for the last few days, and it's astonishing how many stories on Yemen there are from 2015 and how few from 2016. Mm-hmm. It's like the country vanished on the new year.
Yeah. And with mercenaries, I mean, if you think about different periods in 20th century American history and British, I mean, if you keep it out of the media enough, you can have 300, 500, 1,000 special forces people and advisors in all kinds of countries and all kinds of war zones and keep them hot, keep making it worse, but never allowing a resolution, because a resolution could always present political problems and also budgetary problems. You can do that. I mean, God, if you look at, the period of the 1920s, for example, I remember people were starting to think, oh, the 20s, well, that was an anti-interventionist libertarian period in American history. Well, when you actually look at it, we had gunboats and Marines crawling all over China, up and down, collecting on our bonds, up and down Central America, collecting on our bonds, through the Caribbean islands, down through South America. I mean, that's what we did in Turkey. It was usually gunboat diplomacy to get, to open markets or to force governments to pay back bonds that our banks loan them. And then in the Cold War, of course, we had, advisors in a lot of parts of the world fighting insurgencies. So these things could just simmer for years as well, right?
Absolutely. To keep things perking along with low-level sectarian violence in Yemen, it's easy. It's like a perpetual motion machine. Mm-hmm. To do anything more than that, to do anything decisive, what was it? decisive victory or whatever.
That decisive storm.
Decisive storm. Yeah, there ain't going to be no decisive storm.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and so long as it's not in the front page, so long as Tom Friedman isn't asking a taxi driver in Sana'a or Aden what to do, you can keep it going for a while. Yeah, and the budget.
Although I would pay to see a taxi driver spit a mouthful of cot in his face. Well, Tom, you know.
Yeah, that would be good. And him asking where the golf is and explaining to them that until they have a golf course here, they're never going to get their act together.
How much does a Big Mac cost around?
Okay, and on that note, this one, the sound seemed to work out better. So, you know, damn it, the 5-star hotels. You know, it does work that way.
You get what you pay for, even if you do have to listen to a piano playing Bésame Mucho.
So good luck surviving the heat out there. And I guess, you know, we'll find out if you're still, we'll find out next week if you're still going to be in Cambodia, if you'll have made it out to Bangkok, where there's still heat as well. I guess that's it for the show.
Thanks to all our subscribers for making these quixotic bouncing around the world possible.
Thanks to all of our subscribers, and that's it. Bye bye.
Okay. All right. Bye.